What's up, everybody? I hope we're having a great day. I certainly am. My name is Keith Jacobs. This is Crazy Opinionated. Maybe not the opinion that you want to hear, but the opinion that you need to hear. A lot of stuff going on. We got a lot of good NFL things to get to. We got the core four, some betting. I really like my picks this week. We'll talk about a lot of the big deals that are going on in Major League Baseball. Good God. That Garrett Cole signing was absolutely massive. We'll talk about that a little bit. But we'll start with some NFL stuff, and we'll start with the thing that I know certainly Boston people really don't want to hear this. I'm sorry to tell you. I'm just going to be here and give you the harsh reality. The Patriots are not a Super Bowl team. I'm sorry. They're really not. I don't look at this team and see a Super Bowl team. And look, I know what everybody's thinking. The biggest comparison to this team is that Broncos team with Peyton Manning that won the Super Bowl that year, where, you know, they had a quarterback that was, well, I'll say this. Peyton Manning was much more washed up than Tom Brady was, but respectively speaking, both of them were on the back nine, and they both had great defenses. And I get that. But the Patriots' offense is just so unbelievably anemic that I don't even think it really compares. I mean, when you take a look at that Broncos team, at least they had, like, weapons, right? They had Emmanuel Sanders. They had Demaryius Thomas, Julius Thomas. I mean, at least they had some weapons. The Patriots don't have any good weapons, like, straight up. They just don't. I'm sorry. And to put it in perspective for you how anemic their offense is, let me just tell you this. So 2 weeks ago in Houston, the Patriots had more first downs, more total yards, more rushing yards, and led in time of possession. Now, if I just gave you those four stats right there, and I did not provide you any context, and I asked you who won that football game, you would probably tell me the New England Patriots, right? Wrong. No, they didn't. They lost that game. And the reason why they lost that game is because of who is on the other side. DeAndre Hopkins and Will Fuller. Those are the difference. The difference is that all of the teams that are competing for a Super Bowl, you know, the San Franciscos, Baltimore, the Saints, I'll even put Houston in that conversation for the purpose of this argument. Seattle, 100%. The difference between all of those teams and the New England Patriots is that those teams have weapons on the outside. They have impact weapons in the passing game that the New England Patriots just do not have. And I don't want to hear anything about Tom Brady. I know Tom Brady is not playing great football, but he's not playing bad football either. He is absolutely not washed. I don't want to hear that he is. The problem is that he doesn't have anybody good to throw to. Here's how you beat the New England Patriots offense. You double-team Julian Edelman. Yep, that's literally it. That is it. You double-team Julian Edelman. You make the other receivers beat you because they don't have anybody else that can beat you. Julian Edelman is the leading receiver on the team, right? You know who their second leading receiver is? James White, their running back. That goes to show you they don't really have a lot of weapons. And look, all due respect to Julian Edelman, he's more of a number two receiver. Mohamed Sanu, that trade looks like it is a bust of a trade. That has not panned out. The rookie N'Keal Harry, who they drafted in the first round, doesn't seem to be seeing a whole lot of snaps. I don't know if that's because he doesn't know the playbook, if Belichick doesn't trust him. I don't really know what the deal is. And on top of that, they don't have a good tight end. They don't. Honestly, Matt Lacoste is one of their tight ends. He's been cut by three teams in the NFL. And their other tight end is Benjamin Watson, who is soon to turn 39 years old. Now look, Bill Belichick, over the course of his tenure with the New England Patriots, has never really been great at drafting skilled people to begin with. You know, he's had one Pro Bowler out of skilled people that he's drafted over the last 20 years, that being Rob Gronkowski. But Julian Edelman, Julian Edelman came in as a quarterback, all right? And he got transformed into a receiver after about 4 years. But aside from that, they really have never been very good at drafting skilled people. I would say the next best talented player that they drafted out of college, as far as skilled people goes, is Aaron Hernandez. Like, Right? And on top of that, it's not like Tom Brady is getting a lot of protection. The offensive line is injured. They're really not getting good protection for Tom Brady. They're not running the football very well. All of a sudden, Sony Michel has completely gone into the doghouse. I don't know what that's about. But I'm sorry. You cannot – I know that this defense is good. I get it. I get that this is a very, very good defense, especially in their secondary. I think you can make the argument that Stephon Gilmore is far and away the most talented corner in the NFL outside of Jalen Ramsey. He's got to be the best corner in the NFL. But, I mean, look, they statistically outplayed the Houston Texans and lost. They got outplayed by the Chiefs. They got stomped on by the Baltimore Ravens. Like, this is not a team that's going to make the Super Bowl. I cannot completely doubt them because of the greatness of Tom Brady and because of the greatness of Bill Belichick, but if you're just looking at this team right now at face value, this is not a Super Bowl team. I'm sorry. Now let's talk about another team who thinks they have Super Bowl aspirations, and that is the Dallas Cowboys. Can I petition? I'd actually like to make a petition to just, like, not have any NFC East team go to the playoffs, because this division is just so unbelievably terrible. My God, it is bad. It is just awful. And it's unbelievable, because I look at the top of the division with Dallas and Philadelphia, and I think they have two completely separate problems. The problem for Dallas is absolutely not their personnel. The problem for Dallas is their coaching. It's their coaching and their infrastructure. You want to take a look at a good team? You take a look at their infrastructure. Owner, GM, coach, quarterback. Those are basically the four pillars of the proverbial NFL team's house, if you will, that keep up the house. And if one of those pillars is not good, then the house is going to fall down. And, you know, Jason Garrett is just such a bad coach. He is. He's not a good coach. He has terrible understanding of how to use his offense. And let me give you a couple of examples. So against the Minnesota Vikings, the Dallas Cowboys are playing the Minnesota Vikings. It's primetime football. And Dak Prescott is on fire. He is throwing the football incredibly well. He's got great rhythm. He's got great accuracy, zip to his passes. He seems to be incredibly comfortable in the pocket. He's finding open receivers with ease. And Ezekiel Elliott, all game long, was struggling to run the football. And what do the Dallas Cowboys do? In the fourth quarter, they start feeding Ezekiel Elliott. That doesn't make sense. You're going to take away the ball from Dak Prescott, who has the hot hand. That would be like in basketball if J.J. Redick was insanely hot from the three-point line, and all of a sudden, as the point guard, I just stopped passing to him and started playing iso ball. That doesn't make any sense. You have to keep your guy in the hot hand. And in that final drive against Minnesota, three runs with Zeke, and then the final pass play was to Zeke. I mean, that's just bad use of the offense. And then against the Buffalo Bills on Thanksgiving, Ezekiel Elliott comes out in that game, early on in that football game, and he is running hard, ground and pound. He is accelerating well. He's, you know, using his body extremely well, you know, running downhill at a very, very aggressive pace. And he looked, and it looked like one of those games, and it probably should have been one of those games against a really, really good Buffalo Bills defense, who's third in the NFL against the pass. It should have been one of those games where you hand the ball to Ezekiel Elliott 20 to 25 plus times. But instead, no, that's not. Why would that be what happens? That's not what they do in that game. They basically, I don't want to say ice Ezekiel Elliott, but they don't, you know, give him the proper due. Instead, they make Dak throw the ball 49 times. 49 times. And Ezekiel Elliott had 12 carries in the game for 71 yards. He averaged 5.9 yards a carry. I mean, like, my God, like, it's just lack of awareness. And on top of that, there is clearly, as we have been seeing, a disconnect between Jerry Jones and Jason Garrett. And one of the prime examples of this is after the New England Patriots game, Jason Garrett, because this is one of the games where Brett Maher, their original kicker, struggled before they released him. Jason Garrett went in on a press conference in that game, after that game, and he said that they were going to address their kicking situation. And then Jerry Jones comes out, and he goes, no, we're not. What? You cannot have the owner and the coach of your organization that far off the same page. It doesn't make any sense. There's a huge disconnect in communication here, and I think a lot of it has to do with Jerry Jones. I think a lot of it is Jerry Jones' fault, because Jerry Jones wants to take credit for everything. Jerry Jones wants to go on public radio and, you know, hold press conferences, and you don't really fear Jason Garrett as a head coach. I truly don't think, as much as the Cowboys players want to, you know, completely go against this idea, I don't think that the Cowboys players fully respect Jason Garrett, because they know that if they have a problem, they could just go over his head to Jerry Jones and there won't be any consequences. They will not be reprimanded for that. And I think Jason Garrett, and we're going to get to this in a minute, which is my coaches on the hot seat. Jason Garrett is very easily number one for me. I wouldn't be shocked if he's fired this season. I think that this game coming up with the Los Angeles Rams is going to be really, really telling for me as to whether or not they fire him midseason. I think he's going to get fired anyway, regardless of what happens. The only way he doesn't get fired is if they make the Super Bowl. I think he's going to get fired regardless. My thing is that this game with the Rams, which I think the Rams are going to win, is going to be telling to me as to whether they fire him in the middle of the season or they fire him after the season. And then I take a look at Philadelphia, and Philadelphia's problem is the opposite. Philadelphia just has bad personnel. They have bad personnel. And they've also had a lot of cluster injuries, too. They've had a lot of injuries in the secondary. They've had injuries on their offensive line. DeSean Jackson, their number one deep threat, is hurt. And you take a look at this offense, and everybody wants to rag on Carson Wentz. And look, I'm not going to completely absolve Carson Wentz. I think Carson Wentz has a little bit of a problem with fumbles. I think he holds onto the ball too long, trying to force making big plays. And all of a sudden, he has the yips. Throwing screen passes, which is really interesting. But it is not Carson Wentz's fault. It is not. Carson Wentz is doing the best of what he has. Because you take a look at this offense, they don't have anybody explosive. Alshon Jeffrey can't get consistent separation. Nelson Agholor can't catch. I just don't even know what that is. J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, their rookie draft pick out of Stanford, has not played very well this year. And their other receiver is Greg Ward, who, while he has potential, was a quarterback in college at the University of Houston. So basically, really all you have, and they have a very inconsistent running game with that. So, and they, you know, they don't have Jordan Howard right now. Last night on Monday Night Football against the New York Giants, their number one running back was Boston Scott. It's not his fault. It's not Carson Wentz's fault. And there are other people that want to blame the head coach. And to those people, I would say this. Think of Doug Peterson as a chef. Doug Peterson could be the best chef in the world. He could be Gordon Ramsay level. But if he does not have quality ingredients to work with, then he's not going to be able to prepare a great dish every time. That's just how it is. Same thing goes with play calling. If Doug Peterson doesn't have a number one receiver that has the ability to get separation, if he's working with a receiver in Agholor who can't catch, if he's not working with a consistent turnstile of running backs, and he's basically the only thing that he really has to look forward to that is a sure thing in his offense is his tight end, I mean, what's he really going to do? Like, how good can you do? You know, I don't think that either team really deserves to be in the playoffs. You know, the Eagles proved that after losing to the Miami Dolphins. And I think the Dallas Cowboys are proving that by not being able to beat good teams. You know, we keep hearing all year long about how good this roster is. I really don't care anymore. They can't beat good teams. And they have bad coaching. Is what it is. And I just previously mentioned this. We're going to get into the coaches that I think are on the hot seat. So every year this happens where we get to the end of the year and you know, people want to speculate on who's getting fired. Right, but I got five guys right here who I think are 150% getting fired. And the number one I just alluded to is Jason Garrett. The only way that Jason Garrett saves his job is if he takes this team to the Super Bowl, which is absolutely not happening. Dallas has all sorts of talent. We know that. And it's sad because I think that Jason Garrett's inefficiencies as the coach are causing guys like Dak Prescott to catch blame when it's not their fault. Garrett has absolutely no idea how to manage his offense. He doesn't really – the special teams at times can be a mess. That's coaching. They've had multiple three-game losing streaks this year. That's coaching. That's called the lack of resiliency. And I know some of that is on the players, but as the coach, you have to hold these guys accountable to have a mindset every single game of coming out and playing their hardest. And the Dallas Cowboys, while they have all these great weapons, they got these great, you know, these great players on defense, they're just not getting it done. They're not getting it done. And you can't have a roster like this and underachieve as badly as they are. You just can't. So he's gone for me. The second one is Pat Shurmur. And Pat Shurmur is in his second year as head coach. And I personally am a Giants fan. I have been trying all year long to justify not firing Pat Shurmur. I've run out of reasons. You know, the one reason that I really thought, if anything could stick was, you know, just it's year one for Daniel Jones, and maybe you go into next year, year two, with the Daniel Jones-Pat Shurmur combination together, you get some continuity in there. But this team does not play hard. They're on a nine-game losing streak. They're not buttoned up. And this is something that I've heard, is that Pat Shurmur does not meet with his quarterbacks every week. Are you kidding me? You're an offensive coach, and you don't meet with your players every week, your quarterbacks every week? It's atrocious. It's absolutely unbelievable. The Giants offense struggles to have any consistency on offense. They struggle to move the ball for entire halves at times. Their defense is just awful. And I don't, you know, Pat Shurmur is not an alpha at all. I don't think he commands that locker room. I'd be shocked if he survives another season. The same thing goes with the GM, Dave Gettleman. Number three is Freddie Kitchens. Now, look, I am not really a huge believer in firing your head coach after the first year. I didn't love it when Arizona did it with Steve Wilkes. But I'm sorry, this is the one head coach firing after the first year that I am 150% behind. 100% behind it. This is, on paper, arguably one of the most, if not the most, physically gifted teams in football. Baker Mayfield is a good quarterback. He's regressed. I'm not gonna lie. He's regressed, but he's a good quarterback. You got two good running backs in Kareem Hunt and Nick Chubb. Receivers that are just great players. Odell Beckham, Jarvis Landry, David Njoku, the tight end when he's healthy. You got solid players on defense, two good corners, a couple good pass rushers. But this team is just so incredibly undisciplined. They're first in penalty yards. They have the most penalty yards in the NFL. They're an undisciplined team. They're an immature team. You got Baker Mayfield calling out the training staff. You got, they're so undisciplined to the point where Myles Garrett is, you know, smashing people over the head with helmets. And then I think what really broke the straw on the camel's back, for me is when I saw a picture of Freddie Kitchens wearing a Pittsburgh Started It shirt. Are you serious? That's a head coach. That is a head coach of an NFL team. And you are showing such unbelievable immaturity, such an unbelievable lack of self-awareness to wear that shirt. You do realize that, A, that was the most embarrassing moment in the history of your franchise, and B, that is a moment where your best defensive player, your former number one pick, got suspended indefinitely. Do you have any idea what indefinitely means? That means forever, until Roger Goodell says that he can come back. So I'm sorry. Freddie Kitchens is in over his head. He has no idea how to, you know, keep everybody happy in this offense. He doesn't understand how to use his weapons. And he's just incredibly immature. And you can see that immaturity and that lack of discipline trickle all the way down to his players. They're an undisciplined team. Number four for me is Dan Quinn. Dan Quinn, it's really, really interesting to me. Dan Quinn was the defensive coordinator for the Legion of Boom. And this is arguably one of the worst defensive teams in all of football. Like, it's so bad over there. And they started 1-7. I'm sure that's really, that's definitely going to help his case as far as getting fired goes. But Atlanta just needs to move on in a new direction. I know, you know, look, I will say this. I do think that there has been a significant drop-off with this team ever since Kyle Shanahan left and took the head coaching job over at San Francisco. But they just can't survive this start. They're 21st in total defense under Dan Quinn. They're 21st against the pass, and they're 24th against the pass, excuse me. And they're 15th against the run. I mean, and when you're a defensive head coach, you can't have defensive numbers like that. Look, the offense is one thing. The offense is completely one thing. But if you're going to be a defensive coach in this league, you can't play as bad of defense as Atlanta has playing. Now, I know they've gotten better over their last couple of games. You know, they seem to be able to, you know, score on offense more efficiently. You know, they're 4-9 right now. You know, they've won 4 of 6 after their 1 of 7 start, which is better. But I just don't think that Dan Quinn is going to be able to survive. And my number 5-1, my last one is Doug Marrone. I simply think that the Jacksonville Jaguars have given up on Doug Marrone. They have. The Jaguars are 4-9 right now. And Jacksonville's on a 5-game losing streak. And during that 5-game losing streak, they've been outscored 174-57. It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, and the Nick Foles signing, I know he was injured for most of the year, but their offense with Nick Foles has not worked out. That contract has not worked out so far. And the one thing that they did have going for them, which was their defense is even looking bad now. Their defense is not that good. They just allowed the Chargers to absolutely steamroll them. The Chargers put up 45 points on Jacksonville last week. So, I mean, to me, there's no escaping it. There's no escaping it. I think the Jacksonville Jaguars have quit on Doug Marrone. I don't really know what they're going to do as far as their next idea for a coaching hire, but we'll see. All right, so now we're going to get into some sports betting this week. I feel really good about my picks. And one of my picks is kind of crazy, but I think it's going to be good. All right, so the first one, Houston is at Tennessee, -3 for Tennessee. Tennessee is getting 3 points at home. I'm taking the Titans. I mean, first of all, I'm really worried about Houston. They just got steamrolled by the Denver Broncos. Drew Locke had an absolute field day in just his, I think it was his second NFL start. But, you know, Tennessee is a really good football team, man. Tennessee's 5-1 since Ryan Tannehill took over as the starter. They're currently number one in the NFL in yards per play since week 10. That means they can move the football effectively. They can make big plays. They can ground and pound you with Derrick Henry. And Houston, over their last 4 games, has allowed 134 rushing yards per game. And Derrick Henry, over his last 4 games, is currently coming in averaging 150 yards per game and 7 TDs over that 4-game span. Listen, Ryan Tannehill has really taken over this team. He's much better than Marcus Mariota. They're playing with much more juice. There's a lot of firepower here. They got a really good running back. A.J. Brown, I think, has fully established himself as a number one receiver. Ryan Tannehill can throw the football over the yard. I think Mike Vrabel is a very good coach. And quite simply, I just don't trust Houston. I don't really know what to make of Houston week to week. If Deshaun Watson isn't going out there and throwing 4 touchdowns and 350 yards a game, then they're not good enough. Their defense is not good enough. And this is a team that is incredibly Deshaun Watson dependent. And Tennessee is playing really, really good, tough football right now. So I'm going to take Tennessee at home -3. I actually think they win this game comfortably. Now this next one, and you're going to think I'm a little bit nuts on this. I'm going to take Miami +3.5 on the road against the New York Giants. The New York Giants are struggling. They're playing really bad football. They've lost 9 games in a row. They're allowing 30 points per game over that span. and they're 26th against the pass. And Ryan Fitzpatrick has been quietly pretty good over his last six games. He's averaging 267 yards per game in the air, and Miami is 3-3 of their last six. Miami as a football team, I know that they're tanking, quote-unquote, but they make the Giants look like an embarrassment. They're both bad teams, but Miami plays hard every single week. They're well-coached. And the Giants are just a slot fest. They're an absolute slot fest. I think they've given up on Pat Shurmur, number one. And number two, you know, I think that this game, really more than anything, is not about winning. I think this is more so just going to be one of those, you know, Eli Manning last hurrah type of games. It's probable that Eli Manning is going to start again this week. I think the New York Giants have quit. I think the Giants are, you know, probably going to be able to vie for a top two pick in the NFL draft. They need to go out and get Chase Young 100%, the defensive end from Ohio State. I think Miami comes in, and I'm going to take Miami on the upset, +3.5, but I think they win more comfortably than that. Now, my next one, and I think this is going to be one of the grittiest games of the year. Buffalo going into Pittsburgh. Buffalo is +2 in this game. I'm taking Buffalo. The first thing that I don't really love is that Pittsburgh this year is 1-4 against teams above 500. Now, I know Pittsburgh's defense is really good. They're leading the NFL in sacks, and they're leading the NFL in takeaways. They will be the first team in NFL history since the 1974 Pittsburgh Steelers to lead the NFL in both categories if they keep that up. But again, you take a look at this Pittsburgh team, you know, Juju Smith-Schuster and James Conner are, you know, questionable to come back this week. And this is a really, really good Bills defense. The Bills are second in points allowed, third in pass defense, and third in total defense. And something that I really love is that Buffalo hasn't lost two games in a row all year long. What does that tell you? They have great coaching, and they're incredibly resilient as a team. And I think that Buffalo, because of the way they play football, they have a great all-around defense. They can smash mouth you up the middle with Devin Singletary. And Josh Allen is a dual threat, has the ability to run the football effectively, has a very strong arm. That arm strength is going to play really well in the cold weather at night in Pittsburgh. Listen, I give Pittsburgh a lot of credit. I think Mike Tomlin should be up for Coach of the Year with all of the injury problems that they've had on their offense. But I think Pittsburgh just quite simply is not as good of a football team as Buffalo. And I think Buffalo is going to go in there. This is going to be a really, really tight football game. It's going to be a low-scoring football game. But I'm going to take Buffalo to win +2 in this game. I think they win this game outright. And my final one, and I alluded to this one earlier, Los Angeles Rams on the road -1 against Dallas. I'm going to take the Rams in this game. The Rams are starting to kind of catch fire a little bit. The last two games, Jared Goff is averaging 358 yards per game, excuse me, four touchdowns, and he's got a 107.9 passer rating. And think about something. Think about this. Todd Gurley coming back into the mix. This is very interesting. Todd Gurley's had back-to-back games of 18-plus carries. That hasn't happened all year long. He's coming off of a 23-carry game in his last game against Seattle. And they're starting, you know, Los Angeles is starting to get their offense going. I think Jared Goff is getting more comfortable a little bit over these last couple of games. You can kind of see that he's starting to get more comfortable in the pocket, starting to get a better feel for his throws. And if there's one thing that Dallas has a really big problem with doing, it's struggling to make quarterbacks uncomfortable. It's struggling to make quarterbacks feel like they have to force the ball. They're struggling to get takeaways. Dallas, over the last five games, has two takeaways. Yes, you heard me right. Two. They are struggling to create turnovers. They've had two or less sacks in each of their last three games, meaning they're not really doing a good job of getting good penetration. They're not pressuring the quarterback well. And also, on top of that, this is a coaching mismatch. This is absolutely 100% a coaching mismatch. Now, the reason why it's -1, I think, on this line is because Dallas has such a good roster that they are going to be able to match the Los Angeles Rams. But what it really comes down to is the coaching. And Sean McVay is far and away a better coach than Jason Garrett, plain and simple. So I'm going to take the Los Angeles Rams to win this game -1 at Dallas. So just to go over those picks again, I'm taking Tennessee -3, Miami the underdog +3.5, Buffalo the underdog +2, and the Rams -1 at Dallas. I think this is a really big game for Dallas because on the other side, Philadelphia plays Washington this week. I think that's a game that they could very easily win. And so because of that, Dallas has to play with a sense of urgency, which is why I wouldn't really be 100% shocked if they won, but I don't think they will win. Ooh, so let's move on to baseball, shall we? So a really, really big deal happened last night. Gerrit Cole signed with the New York Yankees. 9 years, $324 million. That's an average annual value of $36 million per year. That makes him the highest, that gives him the highest paid contract in the history of baseball for a pitcher. $324 million. That's really unbelievable stuff. Now, he does have an opt-out clause after his fifth year. But my guess is that this is going to pan out really well for the Yankees, especially early on. I mean, you look at this roster, they certainly have the offensive firepower. We know that. They have a great bullpen. You know, you talk about guys like Aroldis Chapman, Tommy Canley, Zach Britton. And I think they have pieces of their rotation that could be very good. Tanaka's a little bit inconsistent, but we've seen him be dominant. Paxton is inconsistent. And Severino just has to stay healthy because he certainly has the lights out stuff to be able to do it. But this is a necessary move. And one of the things, it's interesting because I was talking with some of my friends last night. Some of my friends are Yankees fans. And I was talking to them a little bit about it, about this deal. And they love this deal. But then one of my friends brought up a very interesting point, which is the Yankees struggled to score runs in the playoffs. So he didn't really see why the Gerrit Cole signing makes sense. And to that, I'll say this. You cannot slug your way to a World Series. That's abundantly clear. We know that. If anybody is the depiction of that, it is the Texas Rangers of, you know, the early 2010, of the early 2010s, with those teams with Josh Hamilton and Nelson Cruz and those boys. Like if you could slug your way to a World Series, the Texas Rangers would have won like multiple World Series titles. But the problem is that a team like the New York Yankees, when you have an offense that is great and you have a pitching staff that is inconsistent, it's like an NFL team that has a great offense but a bad defense. You're going to constantly find yourself in shootouts all the time. It's going to put a lot of pressure on your quarterback. It's going to put a lot of pressure on your receivers and your running back to be able to make plays. And it's not always going to work every week. You know, sometimes your defense gives up 35 points and you score 32. Sometimes your defense gives up 10 and you score 6. You know, it puts a lot of pressure on your offense week to week to go out there and put up points, and you're not always going to be able to put up points in it every week. Same thing goes for Major League Baseball, is that if you go out there and you look at the offense and you say to yourself, oh, you know what, boys, we may have to go out here and score 5 or 6 runs today because we don't know if this pitching staff is going to be able to hold it down on the other side. Well, then now guys start to get away from their approach. Guys start to, you know, swing at bad pitches. They get out of their, you know, they get out of the rhythm of their swing. They start to try to do too much. They force the issue. You know, maybe on the base paths, they make bad running mistakes. They steal when they don't have a good jump. They try to take the extra base at a bad time. You know, they try to, you know, to go first to third with two outs, something, you know, something like that. You know, it puts a lot of pressure on the offense. So when you have a pitching staff that is great, it takes pressure off the offense because, you know, every single game, you don't have to go out there and score 5 or 6 runs. You can score 2 or 3 and understand that your guy is going to be able to hold it down on the mound. That's the kind of security that Gerrit Cole brings you. And Gerrit Cole brings you A-plus stuff. He brings you A-plus mentality. And he brings you A-plus experience now because he's been able to go deep, in the playoffs with the Houston Astros. And so this is an unbelievable signing for the New York Yankees. This money is just ridiculous, but the New York Yankees can spend that type of money. So, I mean, it's whatever. And now let's talk about a guy who got another really big contract in Major League Baseball, Steven Strasburg. Strasburg signed You'll have to excuse me. I have a little bit of a cough going on. So that's pretty much why I continue to do that over the course of this video. Steven Strasburg re-signed with the Washington Nationals. He signed a 7-year deal worth $245 million. And this is really, really good for Strasburg. Strasburg was unbelievable in the postseason. He won World Series MVP. And he has been a really, really good pitcher all throughout the course of his career. Now, there was a point where, you know, he had Tommy John surgery. And it took him like a year or two to kind of get back to full form. But aside from that, he's been great. He's been absolutely fantastic. His stuff has played really well. He's kind of been able to be low-key in that rotation because you have Max Scherzer up at the top. But this is really, really important. And the reason why I think it's really important, it tells me two things. Number one, the Nationals don't believe that they're going to sign Anthony Rendon. I think it's plain and simple. If you do not sign Steven Strasburg to as big of a deal as you do, you let him walk, quite frankly, because if this is the number that he was asking for to begin with, this is a really, really big number. But this tells me that they're not signing Anthony Rendon, because Anthony Rendon is going to command a ton of money on the open market. A ton. And so they signed into this really big deal. That's what this tells me. But number two, this tells me that they really value their team. They value their team without Anthony Rendon. Now, they're going to have this kid coming up this year. His name is Connor Kaiboom, and he's a big, powerful dude from the minor leagues. He's a middle infielder, and I think he's going to slide into their middle infield very, very nicely. But they highly value their team. That's what this tells me. Now, I still think they have to go out there and fix their bullpen. I still have a lot of problems with their bullpen. But Strasburg has been awesome. He's had 15 plus wins each of the last four seasons. This year, he threw 209 innings. It was only the second time of his career outside of 2014 where he's thrown over 200 innings. So what is it, you know, which actually you may think of that as a bad thing, because you may think, hey, you know, this guy is not a consistent workhorse. I know he's had some injury problems in his career. But what that also tells me is that he also has not logged an insane amount of innings. And because of that, even at 31 years old, the dude's arm is fresh, man. That's what that tells me. And look, he changed up his training approach. He talked about this a little bit, where he started to, you know, kind of go more towards a strength-based training approach, more so than, you know, just a regular stamina, flexibility type of training approach. And what that's going to allow you to do is, when you add more strength to your body, it's going to allow your body to sustain larger amounts of loads and torque. So basically what I just said is, his body's not going to get as worn down. You know, he's going to be able to maintain strength in his body. He's going to be able to maintain strength in his muscles, which over time, as he continues to log more innings over the course of his career, and this is especially the case as he ages, he's going to be able to sustain strength. He's going to be able to sustain health in his body. Now, of course, he's not doing this, you know, he's not overdoing it. You know, he's not getting like Noah Syndergaard, where he's, you know, built like an NFL linebacker. But he's doing good. He's doing good. So I'm really happy for him. I think he is incredibly well deserving of this deal. You know, obviously was unbelievable in the postseason. He's been a great pitcher for years now. I 100% believe in my mind that he definitely deserved all of the money that he has been given. So now we're going to talk a little bit of NBA. Let's check into the NBA. And the main thing that I want to discuss is the New York Knicks. Because, my God, like, they'll just never figure it out. They won't. So David Fizdale, their head coach, got fired after a 4-18 start. And it was his first year as the head coach. And according to the Knicks brass, the reason why he was fired is because they had higher expectations of this team. Why? Why do you have higher expectations of this team? I mean, for the love of God, your biggest free agent signing was Julius Randle. And that's no disrespect to Julius Randle. Julius Randle's a nice player. But if that is the number one free agent acquisition that you make over the course of an offseason, that's not very good. That's not very good. And there's a couple things wrong. Number one, it was David Fizdale's understanding that when he was coming to New York, he was going to have the opportunity, when they were originally in talks about it, he was going to have the opportunity to coach Kristaps Porzingis. And then Kristaps Porzingis was traded to the Dallas Mavericks. And then on top of that, you know, we heard all of these rumblings all year long. Oh, the Knicks are going to get KD and Kyrie. And then all of a sudden, that doesn't happen. They go to the New Jersey Nets, the Brooklyn Nets, excuse me. And so their biggest free agent acquisitions, they went out and they got Julius Randle, Taj Gibson. I mean, like, come on. Like, how good did you honestly expect this team to be? You have a rookie draft pick in R.J. Barrett, who's still developing his game. Kevin Knox, who is still developing his game. And there's just a lot of players on this team that just are just like average NBA players. It is what it is. They're average NBA players. And the problem is that the Knicks are just a historically dysfunctional organization. Ever since James Dolan has taken over as the owner, they're a dysfunctional organization. And it's very difficult to overcome dysfunction. It really is, especially when it's your owner. You know, it's one thing if your coach is dysfunctional because you can replace a coach. It's one thing if your GM is dysfunctional because you can replace a GM. You can't replace an owner unless he chooses to sell the team, which James Dolan is not going to do anytime soon. It's just a disaster, man. It really is. And here's the other thing, too, is that David Fizdale's firing should be a giant red. This should be a giant red stop sign to any high quality coach, because I've heard multiple names so far come up for the New York Knicks job. I've heard Mark Jackson. I've heard Jeff Van Gundy. I've heard Becky Hammond, the assistant coaches for the San Antonio Spurs. If I am any one of those three people, I am not touching the New York Knicks with a 10-foot pole. Because number one, I don't want to work for a dysfunctional owner. And number two, I don't want to lack a job. Like, the moment you sign the contract to become the head coach of the New York Knicks, you're already lacking job security. It is what it is. Like, David Fizdale is now being paid a ton of money to not coach the New York Knicks. There was no job security for him after, what was it, 22 games? Which is embarrassing. And the New York Knicks continue, and you know, the Knicks and Knicks fans continue to wonder why they never get any big play, you know, any big pieces in free agency. This is why. Because you're working for a dysfunctional organization, and nobody likes dysfunction. Nobody wants to go in there, and you know, no coach wants to go in there and worry about their job security. I'm sorry. And no player wants to play for a dysfunctional owner, because it creates a bad environment to be in. And the New York Knicks, I'm sorry to say it, but the only way they're going to be able to fix this is if James Dolan sells the team. Because there's only so much drafting and player development that you can do before it gets to a point where you're like, okay, there's something really wrong here. And let me also add this too. The player development is a result of the coaching. It is. The player development is a result of the coaching. And it's not because the coaching has been bad. It's because the coaching hasn't had the opportunity to actually do anything. How is a coaching staff supposed to develop players when they're not there for more than 25 games? Or they're not there for more than a year? Like, you know, they've drafted a lot of guys. You know, they drafted some players who, you know, outside of Kristaps and R.J. Barrett, have been not impressive. And a lot of it has to do, you know, some of it has to do with the fact that they just don't have their coaching staff intact to be able to develop these guys. And it's really, really sad. And I feel so bad for New York Knicks fans, because until James Dolan sells the team and they find a way to go in a new direction, there is nothing positive that is ever going to get done in New York.